afternoon, committee members and guests. So we don't have enough. We're one short of quorum yet, so we'll hold off on the minute approval for the last two meetings. But we will go ahead and ask our testifiers to come down. Today's topic of today's hearing is hearing a presentation on the working group that worked on the teacher development evaluation and alternative teacher professional pay system, a working group that was has been going on and has recently issued their report. So we've got a number of people that are going to testify on this today. Assistant Commissioner from the Department of Education, the two working group co-chairs, and then some other invited testifiers who will be giving comments. So with that, welcome to the committee. We are very pleased to receive your testimony. If you would each, before you speak, just state your name for the record, and please proceed.
Okay, Madam Chair, my name is Rose Hermanson. I'm with the Department of Education.
Madam Chair, I'm Kelly Spies, and I am from Bloomington Public Schools.
Madam Chair, I'm Misty Sato, Professor of Teacher Development at the University of Minnesota.
Well, welcome to all of you. We appreciate you being here and offering the good work of the group. And whoever would like to lead off, please go right ahead.
Okay, Madam Chair, I'm going to begin. Misty and Kelly were the co-chairs of the committee. My role here today is just to basically provide some foundation for both programs. I know we have some new members, and so that we understand what both programs are designed to do. Misty and Kelly will then go through the recommendations from the work group. I also have available staff. I have with me Tyler Livingston, who was primarily responsible for the development of the teacher evaluation system and is now currently he worked with that work group as they developed it and with the implementation. I also have Christy Anderson, who has been with the department for several years and has worked on the QCOMP or the ATPPS program, so we can provide information. I also have staff from Tom Melchershop, who can answer questions on funding if you have those. So we'll try to give you as much information as we can, and I'm sure there will be some questions we end up not being able to answer, but we'll do our best. With that, I'm going to begin and provide some background. My work on this is I worked with both the teacher evaluation system and was involved with the some of the original alternative teacher professional pay system. My one of my assignments was also to pull together this work group to align the two systems, which we did through outreach to a variety of stakeholders in the state. The charge to the work group, the specific one that this work group received, was to align Minnesota's alternative teacher professional pay system, and the statutory citations are there, and the teacher development evaluation program. The QCOMP or ATPPS system has its own statutory language. The teacher development and evaluation system is embedded in the teacher continuing contract law and the Tenure Act for cities of the first class. Then they are also supposed to make recommendations on how to affect and fund and improve the alignment of these programs and systems. Just some acronyms here that you'll see being used. ATPPS, it stands for Alternative Teacher Professional Pay System. If you look in the statute, you're not going to see QCOMP, but it's frequently referred to as QCOMP when it's talked about. And TDE will be the teacher development or the evaluation system, as we talked through our. The background and context for the alternative pay system, actually it started under, there were five pilot projects developed under the Ventura administration, and there was only $3.6 million that were allocated. The focus of that alternative pay system was to provide alternative teacher salary schedules and develop career ladders. And we have there were five districts that were approved, and we have the superintendent of one of those districts in the audience today, so she was one of the pioneers in looking at this. And then in 2005, this changed into a more robust system called QCOMP or ATPPS. At that time, and currently, there's about $75 million annually allotted toward implementation of that system. This came in under the Plenty administration starting in 2005. And again, the focus here was on student and teacher growth. There are four basic elements in the QCOMP system or the ATPS. Career ladders or teacher leader options, ongoing site-based professional development, teacher evaluation, teacher compensation, performance pay. And in the QCOMP system, there's a robust process of a letter of intent comes from the district. They have to submit an application, and that application has to be signed off by both the district and the teacher leaders. They have to have site goals identified. There is a program update, and there's more monitoring of the QCOMP system than there is, you'll see, with the teacher evaluation system, and there's more of an approval process, technical assistance, and the districts do not go forward until their plans are approved. And there's also compliance monitoring with an annual report. Under the QCOMP system, we have set up a system of UFARS reporting to find out where the money is being spent as well. Participation for QCOMP in the 2014-15 school year, 81 of 337 districts were participating. However, that covers nearly half the students in the state. So what we find is the districts tend to be larger. We have 69 of 157 charter schools participating. And so even though the district numbers are more limited, the actual number of students in the state that are included under those districts is about half and half. And you'll see the impact of this later when we start talking about funding, because the funding is on a per pupil basis. If all approved plans receive funding and vote to implement, the 2015 will have 85. There's some issues here because we have a cap on the funding. We have some plans that have been approved, but they haven't gone forward because the cap has been reached. We have a district that's receiving partial funding and have decided to go forward anyway, and we've also had some districts that indicated that we had some districts withdraw an application as well, and we have others indicated they would participate, but the funding is not available. Charters, we have 69 of 157 charters currently participating in QCOMP. This is the funding. It's $75.635 million in basic state aid. There's also a levy. I'm going to make one correction on this side as we get to charters. The funding is available and plans implementation is available for the following types of districts. Just to note, this does not necessarily cover all of our teachers in the state. So as we get into teacher evaluation, there are additional types of district organizations that will be required to do teacher evaluation that do not necessarily qualify for QCOMP because of the designations and statute. But you can see that we do cover most of the districts. Under charter schools, the makeup of the funding is basically $169 per pupil in state aid, and the districts can approve a levies for up to $91 in addition to that basic state aid. So in total, it's about $260 per pupil statewide. Charter schools, because they have no levy authority, they have no area to levy on, they get an equalized state aid that's approximately the average of the average levies of districts, and that should really be, instead of 243 or one correction here, that should be $254. Our staff in finance corrected me this morning on that. This is an old number. But $254 is an additional average levy amount per student that the districts, that the charters get. Staffing for the QCOMP or ATPPS system, all of our staffing to do this work has been through federal dollars. And it's Title II money. I just want to note for the committee that as these programs are implemented, the requirement in the QCOMP program to have these programs approved by the department and all of the help and funding does take staff time. And at the current, and I think that basically for most of the implementation of QCOMP, it has been using federal Title II dollars to make this program or implement this program. And as it says, MDE did not receive state funding to implement the ATPPS program through all the years that it's been going forward. Just a note for you. Background and context for teacher evaluation. This is a statutory requirement. QCOMP, by the way, is voluntary. Districts do not have to do it. As I said, there's many that do, covering a lot of many of our students. Teacher development and evaluation system is a required or mandated program for all districts. It's embedded in our continuing contract tenure laws. I've cited those. Process is similar, and I'll get to similarities and differences later. The requirement is for implementation in the 2014-15 school year, which is this school year. It passed in 2011. The department was directed working with stakeholders group to develop a model that would be implemented. Should districts not reach agreement, the department did go through with that process with another stakeholders group and developed the model. We have people in the audience who actually were part of that stakeholders group that helped develop the model. We piloted the model last year. We did receive some funding to help pilot the model out in districts, or components of the model teacher development. Districts have the right, although we have a model evaluation program available for districts to use, districts have the right to develop their own evaluation system as long as they meet components that are specified in statute. The local plans are to be developed through joint agreement. This does not apply to charters. I'll talk a little bit about that later. But the joint agreement, again, is similar to QCOMP. It's not necessarily embedded in the contract, but it's required that both the district and the teacher leaders sign off on the whatever they finally agree to. In practice, what we're seeing with our teacher evaluation, our model, some districts are taking portions of it and then modifying it, which is to be expected, because a teacher evaluation model we had to design had to cover districts with 4,000 teachers and districts with maybe 20 teachers. And so there are different types of teachers in districts that may not be in other districts, the number of special ed teachers, the number of specialized programs are offering. So there's a lot of variation as you go around the state about how the model may look because of the teaching staff they employ. We did the stakeholder group, as I mentioned. The example model was piloted the past year. Here are the components in statute that we had to have in our model and also have to be in the local districts. The purpose was to develop and improve and support qualified teachers and effective teaching practices to improve student learning and success. They have to be based on professional teaching standards in rule. And just for your information, the professional teaching standards we have in rule are under the Board of Teaching. They're not a department rule, they're Board of Teaching rules. And they have been developed through a rulemaking process. 35% of the evaluations must be based on student academic growth and literacy. And again, we have to have valid and reliable assessments using state and local measures. Again, this is when the group putting together the teacher evaluation model worked on this. You know, we have our MCAs and we have statewide tests, but we also have a lot of teachers who are not that, you know, kindergarten through third grade. We don't test in MCAs. So you get into high school, you have different, you know, physics and science and social studies. And so the group worked diligently at finding ways to come up with that measure, 35% measure of student success, and offering options for districts to implement and use. We have to use longitudinal data on student engagement and other student outcome measures. And this, again, required some work to find ways of doing that. Many are using student surveys, but that is a measure that's required in statute. And the teacher improvement process for meeting, there has to be a teacher improvement process. So in the teacher evaluations, there's three basic components, which are really the student growth and student achievement measures, student engagement measures, and then what we traditionally have known as the observation of teacher practice. So those are the three basic components. At the end of that evaluation process, there has to be a plan in place for helping teachers improve that are not meeting the standards or have need for improvement. The teacher evaluation process is on a 3-year professional review cycle. In other words, every teacher has to complete this in process and receive a summative evaluation at the end of a 3-year period. There has to be an individual growth and development plan associated with the results. There's a peer review process in place where they get feedback by their teachers. The summative evaluation is by a trained and qualified evaluator, most often a school administrator. But in the interim years, there's also support through a teacher review process. I talked already about the joint agreement. If the districts don't reach that, they have to implement the state model. Joint agreement is not a part of the charters because many of them don't necessarily have teacher union representatives. They may not be organized in that way. We have asked for letters of assurances that the districts are implementing this model because they start this year. And the other assurances is either by a charter director that they're following the law and implementing. If you read the charter law, what it says in the charter law is that they must have a plan in place for teacher evaluation, and it must comply with the provisions, provisions 2 through 13 of what's in the teacher continuing contract law. Charter schools are not subject to the teacher continuing contract law, but we make the reference back to that so that the provisions under which they're being evaluated are the same. Funding fiscal year 2015 only, we mentioned the number. The districts that do not have a QCOMP or HTPS plan, they get $302 times the number of FTE teachers that they employed on October 1st. So the funding for QCOMP was totally about 9 to 10 million, and it's by teacher, it's not by student. There was some state dollars allocated for, I think, a 2-year cycle for implementation. It's not ongoing funding. I might note that prior to the teacher evaluation, you asked us to develop a plan for principal evaluation, and that was to go in effect 1 year sooner than teacher evaluation. We had no state funding for doing that model. We went and got a Bush grant. The money that we used for the Bush grant is what we originally used to help start up the work on the teacher evaluation process, because this staffing and funding came in when that evaluation plan was already kind of developed. So we've tried to pull together money from private sources, as well as there is limited dollars, but you can see how that money, this was allocated in the 2013 session, and the work for teacher evaluation was well underway by that time. Similarities, the purpose is to develop and evaluate teachers and to improve outcomes for students. The QCOMP plan has a robust teacher evaluation component to it, but it has other components that are not in teacher eval. Local controls, the plans are developed locally and collaboratively. There's emphasis on instruction feedback and student outcomes. The role of peer reviewers, coaches of observation and or leadership is in both. There's alignment with staff development and job-embedded learning. And then there's the MDA professional, provides professional and technical assistance. Differences, ATPS can be used for compensation or performance award. The teacher evaluation is silent on that. There's a performance appraisal system and potential for teacher improvement plan that we assume would be covered under staff development dollars. And there's also a provision there for discipline should a teacher not improve over as a result of that plan. MDE authority is different. We have to actually review and approve the plans for QCOMP. We just have to have assurances that the teacher evaluation, because it's a statewide mandate for all districts. The role of teachers, teacher observers must have an evaluative role. There's a lot of emphasis on inter-rater liability as people work within the QCOMP plan. The TD teacher observers may have an evaluative role, but teacher leader or administrator is really the summative evaluator and makes the decisions because it relates to potentially employment. Representative, do you want me to take questions now or do you want to wait?
Representative Erickson, go ahead.
Oh, Madam Chair, I could wait till they're finished, but I do want to ask Ms. Hermanson a question or two.
Okay.
I can wait till they're
finished. Just got a couple of pages left the way it looks. Yeah. So why don't you go ahead and finish, Ms. Hermanson?
Funding, we've covered that a little bit. There's an ongoing source of funding. It's capped. It's a voluntary program. And there's also a local levy involved, up to $260. So the state has $169, and the rest is local levy. TDE was a one-time funding source passed last year. May also use the staff development set aside for funding is another point. MDE role, the local process with an approval and the letter of insurance. Alignment issues that were laid out for the committee to consider are, we looked at process issues and we looked at funding issues as the group went through its work. So they first had to decide, you know, how do we want these two systems to work together before we decide how they might be funded. So there was a lot of discussion around the process issues, and you see all the things that they looked at, including do we want to have the letter of intent, what is the teacher's role, what should the compensation look like, and looking at the three-year professional review cycle, who should be doing the summative evaluation. So those were all issues that the committee looked at in detail as they looked at how they might align these two systems. Again, we talked about the funding. You've already had seen that there's a significant difference if you look at per pupil versus per teacher, and then also what's the annual cost for. They looked at what are the actual costs for implementation, what things are we having to put in place in order to do the implementation of teacher evaluation as it compares to what they are doing with TCOM. With that, I'm going to turn it over to the chairs, who will talk a little more about the actual recommendation. I just wanted to give you a background of what's currently going on in both programs out there and where we are at the current time with implementation. And I'll be happy to take questions now, or if you want to wait until after the recommendations are presented.
Representative Erickson, did your question fit better now? Or
thank you,
or
Madam Chair, yes. Ms. Hermanson, on the evaluation based on professional teaching standards and rule, I'm trying to recall, in the state default model, did you delineate each standard someplace in that model? So that it was that teachers could recognize these are the teaching standards and rule. I haven't looked at it for a while, so
yeah,
I can't remember.
Either. I'm going to have Tyler come up and maybe answer that question.
Okay. If you would please state your name for the record.
Tyler Livingston, MDE.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative. The work group, when they looked at the requirement for the professional teaching standards and rule, which are the standards,
yes,
that higher ed, of course,
yes,
needs to meet to licensed teachers. We found that many of the well-researched evaluation systems and rubrics, such as Marzano,
okay,
Danielson, et cetera, mm-hmm, have a very high alignment with that. So that is the pursuit that the work group used in looking at observation rubrics are very well aligned with professional teaching standards. And
thank you, and that's exactly what I wanted to know, because I know many districts are using Danielson or Marzano. I don't know if you can answer this question or if I need to go back to Ms. Hermanson, but the longitudinal data now that is being collected on student data, how is that being protected?
Mr. Livingston.
Madam Chair, I may have to ask a clarifying question. The longitudinal data on student engagement?
Yes.
And is the data being protected student-identified data?
Yes, correct.
That would be locally. They are determining how to protect student data to ensure that at the district level and at the teacher level, students are de-identified if they're providing feedback through a mechanism like a survey.
Representative Erickson.
And I just have a question for Ms. Hermanson. I think you're the better resource here. The federal $2, Ms. Hermanson, and thank you, Madam Chair, they came under the No Child Left Behind Highly Qualified, is that correct?
Ms. Hermanson.
You mean the Title $2 that were being used for,
correct,
implementation?
Yes.
I'm going to have Christy help me with that because she's been in that program. At this point, we're going to have to get back to you, but
sure,
it is Title II, and I think they've been being used since 2005. And so I'm assuming it was appropriate. I mean, I'd have to go back, and we can get you some more information.
Thank you, because the highly qualified, you know, the designations that came under NCLB had those three criteria, and I would imagine those matched up with the alternative performance pay system. And then finally, you said that you used those dollars to start the teacher eval because the principal's evaluation was already really worked out for the most part.
Ms. Hermanson.
Madam Chair, we used Bush Foundation dollars.
Bush. Oh.
Yeah, it was not, and we'd have to go back and look, but we went to Bush because we had no staffing to start the evaluation process. My major portion of my time was spent on helping develop the work with the work group on both principal evaluation and teacher evaluation, and then when we brought in some staff to help implement that, we realized we needed some additional staffing in place to get work with districts out in the field to help them develop their model. So we spent a lot of time out in the field working with districts, and so we added staff at that point.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Let's see. I have a few members on the list. I think we'll go through unless we want to get to the next phase of the working group recommendations. So I'll go through, and you can determine if your question should wait until after. So Representative Bennett, I had you next.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Hermanson, thanks for your presentation. I have two questions, actually. I'll ask them one at a time, though. My first question is, has there been a study done? This program's been in place for a little while now, but a study or tracking of data to figure out how effective this program is in student achievement?
Ms. Hermanson.
Madam Chair, Representative Bennett, are you talking about QCOMP now or teacher eval?
QCOMP.
Okay.
Sorry.
There have been some studies. We can probably get you some information. I think the results have been mixed. I think there's a person who's going to testify later today that might want to share what they've observed. The department has not done what I would consider a formalized study. Teacher eval, we have asked the Carey Institute from the University of Minnesota to do evaluation of our pilots. And they've given us some preliminary information on feedback on how to improve our teacher eval system. So we are trying to look at the impact of both of these programs.
And if I would interject for the members, there is the executive summary of that report you just referenced in your packets, okay. Members. Representative Bennett.
Thanks, Madam Chair. My other question is, as a teacher who has been in, I'm with the Albert Lea Area Schools and have been under the QCOMP program, we call it ATPPS or same thing, and this might not be something you can answer right now, but just to keep in mind, but how do we stop us doing things? Sometimes we end up doing things for the process instead of for the outcome, and I'll give an example. With teachers, we have 45-minute meetings every week, and we have to meet even though once in a while there's nothing to talk about. We have to sit there anyway, and that just doesn't make sense to me because I guess I'm too practical for that. I want to get to work in my classroom. So how do we make sure, as in any program, that we're not doing it for the process sake instead of for the reason it's there?
Madam Chair, Representative, that's a very good question. We rely on the locals a lot to be sensible about implementation because there's nothing that in our statute that requires that happen. I'm not sure in particular about your process locally, but I'm assuming you're talking about your professional learning community process. Obviously, that many teachers like that process because it helps them jointly plan and look at data about students. But I can't answer specifically about your local, but it seems to me if you had nothing to discuss, you guys would just go back to your classrooms. But I can't help you with the local process like that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is also about QCOMP. It feels to me like it is basically a state-financed alternative teacher pay program that districts may voluntarily choose to enter into. And I'm good with up to that stage. And then, oh, by the way, when we opt in to QComp, we are also requiring local property taxpayers to participate. I thought I heard you say that there was a local levy involved in QComp as well. Does it go automatically with the school board and the bargaining unit's decision to opt into QComp, or is the local levy optional?
Madam Chair, Representative Anzuck, the local levy is optional, and there are districts who choose not to levy it, and so it's not a mandated levy. The state aid would flow regardless of whether they did the local levy. But it is not a mandated levy.
Madam Chair, just briefly, I thank you for the explanation, and it would be good to know how many districts do voluntarily choose to add to the program with local levy.
Madam Chair, if later on I can bring our staff up. I think we may have some of that information in the runs that you have. I don't know, but he can explain that. We have cool staff here that can work
that's
with
good
us. I would like to kind of bring in the idea. In practice with QComp, it's been my observation, even though there's this requirement for an alternative salary structure, and you may hear some testimony later from Jim, what they really think is the most beneficial part is the professional development and the feedback they're getting through their activities. Now, the impact and we have required that they develop potentially an alternative process for paying teachers, and that's part of the approval process, and Christy Anderson can answer more about that. But if we really look at the impact, we see a lot more emphasis and feedback on what it results in relationship to staff development and the teacher evaluation process.
Glad to hear that.
Thank you, Representative Anzos. And we do have some of that information. I'm thinking maybe it would be helpful at this point, since the topic was brought up, to kind of review the funding and how that flows. And maybe I think Representative Mr. Strom may have some of that information you were looking for as well.
Madam Chair, Ms. Johnson and I are just looking through the printout that the department brought with them today, and we think we may need to bring you an additional piece of paper on this to show the districts that are under levying, as I believe what we're seeing here is the maximum available to them. But we may be able to find that before the committee ends here.
All right, very well. Then we'll come back to that, and hopefully we'll have all the pieces that would be of interest to members. So, all right, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the presentation. Like, wow, it has been a decade since this started, and I'm just curious, and I'm not sure exactly who might have that information, what percentages of teachers, the average percent, are receiving additional funds in the QComp districts. And then what is the range, high to low, between the districts of what population is receiving additional compensation through QComp?
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, we don't necessarily collect that information specifically. We know that there are some. We can try to... We did look at some UFARS reports as we were doing the work group, but it doesn't get factored out by the amount of bonuses or compensation that's tied directly to a teacher. In some instances, those reports showed us that they may have brought in place peer reviewers or coaches or something, and their full time may have been spent working on the program, but that would be all listed as salary. We can determine salary, but we don't necessarily know whether that salary was really a bonus or a or a contribution or what, but we can try to find information and get you some. But it's going to be hard because we don't necessarily collect it by district, by how much they're giving each teacher. We have, maybe Kelly, she's a coupon coordinator. She might be able to be more specific for her district, but we would have to go district by district because all of these plans are basically local plans.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it would be nice to know how they're rewarding, the teachers that are taking this and developing and growing and improving, because rewarding quality is a nice thing. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. So I don't have any other people. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Mullery.
Sorry, Madam Chair. I thought you saw my hand before. I have two questions on the evaluation, Ms. Hermanson. The first one kind of seems strange to me. I've talked to one person who, she was a pre-K teacher, and her evaluator was a 12th grade physics teacher who told her he had no idea what she was doing in the classroom. I've heard not quite as strange to me as that, but how effective is that at evaluation? Then my second question is, I've heard from some people who were development trainers or coordinators in school systems who had gone around working with teachers to, they'd sit and discuss with them what the teacher was concerned about of their own lack of ability in a certain area, and what the evaluator, or not the evaluator, but what the person helping them also could see. And they have said that now, since the evaluation could lead to reduction in pay or unemployment, the people helping train the teachers to be better are getting less openness from the teachers about what they need or what they might have as deficiencies. How are you making up for that? Or are you, I assume it's not just the people that I talk to, but it's probably other places happening also.
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, the teacher evaluation system started an implementation that was outlined statute, and local districts began in September of this past year. I'm assuming that there have been districts that have been doing an evaluation process prior to that, and the summative evaluator under the teacher evaluation system is to be an administrator or a highly qualified and trained person. The department is working with districts to assure that we provide that training to help them out. That's part of what we'll, as you listen to the recommendations, we see that's more of our role than the monitoring and compliance, but we are going to do some of that as well. The having a high school teacher evaluate a pre-K, I'm not sure why the district would have done that. It doesn't seem like doing a good job of evaluation, but I, at this point, I'm not sure if that's part of their old evaluation system or their new one. But it would not be one that we would recommend unless there's some skill set that teacher has in working in classrooms that might have been valuable for that teacher. Because, we're going to have the same problems with physics and math teachers in high school having an evaluator that understands the concepts they're teaching in order to fully evaluate whether they're being effective in delivering that. On your second question, would you kind of repeat that quickly again?
Mullery.
Madam Chair, Ms. Hermanson, it's the people who were before this were helping teachers improve themselves.
Correct.
They were kind of, whether it be forced or not, were getting much more openness, they told me, than now that they're evaluating under this system, where it could end up affecting their salary or their employment, that they were getting, they used to get more openness from teachers saying, look, I have problems in this area. Can you help me on this.
Madam Chair and Representative Mulray, I think as we've gone forward and done staff, Tyler and the other staff have gone forward with implementation work with districts, what they are trying to align is the differentiate between the summative evaluators and those peer reviewers and the sisters. They're assisting people understand their practice in a way that there is not this threatening type situation. And you listen to some of the recommendations that come forward. There's discussion about data privacy and what materials may be used for the summative evaluation and whose property they are. In other words, it remains with the teacher, and there was a recommendation that they have to agree to have any feedback released if it's not part of an official summative evaluation. So we're trying to establish practices that will assist teachers without them necessarily feeling threatened as they go through the process of improving their practice. But at some point in time, you're going to have some documents to end up with a summative evaluation that you give back to that teacher. And so it's a balance that we're going to need to work and work with districts. We, from the department, have taken the position that primary purpose here is to improve teacher practice and assist them, and that we should be looking at this as a developmental practice. Having said that, there will be some teachers that will need a development plan that may require some helping of them exiting the profession. But I think that's over a three-year cycle, and with work where they've had a program in place to help them improve, and somehow they've not managed to do that. It's going to be a fine line, but I think overall we're going to work with districts so they have the teachers feel more comfortable that this is something to help them, not necessarily as punitive. But it's going to take work.
I think now would be a good time to turn to the testimony from the working group co-chairs. So whoever wants to lead off.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Misty Sato. I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota, and it was my honor to co-chair this committee with Kelly, and I want to publicly acknowledge the good consensus-building work that this group from many stakeholder groups around the state engaged in during this several-month process. I'll begin with restating the purpose of the task group formation. We were charged with seeking alignment between the Alternative Teacher Performance Pay Statute and the Teacher Development and Evaluation Statute. When we came into this work, we did not have any strong sense that we would emerge from this conversation with a recommendation to carry both forward, to eliminate one, to carry forward one more strongly than the other. But the overall result of the group that you'll hear today in our recommendations is to reach alignment between these two statutes that have a lot of similarities by merging them into one statute that brings a more comprehensive or coherent approach to teacher development and evaluation in the state. At the report that you received, when you read it carefully, we wanted to put a preamble at the beginning to give you a mindset for how to think about the 11 process recommendations that we'll highlight today. The first is that the fundamental expectation is that both laws should be kept in place in future legislative action. So that is the merging of the two different statutes to bring together a coherent system.
I'm sorry, Dr. Sato, are paper copies available for the committee members or no?
That would be the actual report. Yes, Madam Chair. The slides that you're seeing today are just extracts from the actual report of recommendations. So if you have the report in front of you, you could follow through recommendation one at a time.
Thank you.
Our second premise is that the recommendation should be taken as a package and not pulled out as single recommendations, one above the other. Again, we're seeking coherence here and think that the total package of having trained and reliable observers, of having elements that are related to student performance as well as teacher performance and student engagement are all essential pieces of a coherent process for teacher development and evaluation. And the third premise is that the viability of this being successfully administered and developed within the state at the local level will depend on funding of these programs. While we might think that we have had evaluation of teachers going on in schools for many, many years, the technologies and development of new practices that this will require is will require a new set of capacities in the school districts. And there was 1 year of funding put in place last year to help develop and get districts launched. Some school districts have the QCOMP money to continue this work, but we really do strongly recommend that the funding come forward to be able to really make the viability of teacher development and evaluation a strong prospect in Minnesota. I'm going to turn this over to Kelly, but just highlight that there are 11 process recommendations that would be what would be considered designing an evaluation system that is strongly developmentally centered, and 3 funding recommendations that will go back to what Rose reported on earlier in terms of how to think about some of the QCOMP funding structure as it relates to the teacher development and evaluation process, which is in place now without existing funding in statute.
I'm going to go through each of the recommendations, and you'll notice this is just a summary of each of the recommendations. And just to reiterate what Misty just said, it's just important that you realize that this is a package, and each one may build on another or may rely on another to put a fully comprehensive teacher evaluation program together. Also, Ms. Hermanson talked about the similarities. You're going to see a lot of the similarities between the QCOMP program and the TDE come through with each of these recommendations. Recommendation one is that the program should continue to be developed locally. It's important that we have the support and understanding of teachers as these programs go forward. Recommendation two is the focus should be on the development and evaluation of teachers as a means of improving those student outcomes. Some of the questions alluded to that. Yes, this is about teacher development and about evaluation that improves what happens in the classroom. The summative evaluation should be based on a 3-year data collection cycle. And that data collection would include those student engagement measures that were asked about earlier, and also the feedback that the teacher receives from both administration, could be from mentors, or it could be from peer observers as well. The recommendation four is the measures of teachers' effectiveness should reflect that data on student academic growth, observation of teacher practice, and student engagement. Recommendation five is professional development opportunities should be embedded in the regular working day. These can include those teacher-to-teacher interactions, that coaching that goes on between the teacher, the peer coach, a mentor, an administrator, as well as professional learning communities that are set up in many districts already. Recommendation six, the program should include opportunities for teachers to take on professional roles, to be a peer observer, to mentor other teachers, to be an instructional coach within different content areas or special programs. Recommendation seven, this was asked about earlier as well. All data in the program should be considered personnel data. It should only be disclosed with teacher's consent. And the protocols for aggregating school or district data should assure the anonymity of individuals, both teachers and students. Recommendation eight is that the alternative compensation is locally determined. Some districts within QCOMP could continue that alternative compensation, but if districts have another plan that doesn't include that, it would not have to. The definition of a teacher is based on the Minnesota Statute 122A, and that's a Minnesota valid Minnesota teacher license. Recommendation 10 is the role of MDE. Rose talked about earlier the letter of assurance. That would continue as a part of these recommendations. And implementation and support through that professional development, the training that MD provides to districts to do QComp would continue as we meld the TDE and QComp programs together. Technical assistance when needed, and support in reporting on the local use of the state funding. The last recommendation that we have here is that the evaluation of the probationary teachers would align with those same evaluation expectations in the combined TDE and ATPPS statute. I'm going to turn it over to Misty for some funding recommendations.
Madam Chair, may I ask a question of Ms. Feese?
Representative Erickson, would it be all right if we finish this short and go back to questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're bringing forward three recommendations for funding, again, recognizing that the ATPPS program is a voluntary program and has state funding in place, and the teacher development and evaluation process is mandated for all school districts, yet has no state funding, ongoing state funding in place. So our recommendation is to provide equal funding provided to all districts at the level currently available under the statute identified here in the slide, which is the current QComp or ATPPS funding level at $169 per student. We think that this will equalize the funding available across all districts in Minnesota. We currently have 50% of our students who have access to this funding under the QComp, while 50% do not at the current time. The second funding recommendation targets where we think these dollars should be spent at the local level, and that we would ask that they be spent specifically for activities that are identified in the current TDE statute, which is targeted toward summative evaluation in the three-year cycle, the student academic growth measures, student engagement measures, professional roles for teachers, individual growth and development plans, classroom observations and feedback, and the job-embedded professional development. If you hearken back to the recommendation, this would mean that this state funding would not be used for alternative compensation or for performance pay, but our third recommendation would allow for that, giving districts districts and charters the option of applying for local levies if they wanted to go beyond the basic recommendations that were listed previously, that are the requirements under the teacher development and evaluation statute. So if a district opted to take up any three of these additional activities that are related to professional development and alternative compensation or performance pay, they would have the option of pursuing local levies to pay for these kinds of activities: additional teacher leadership positions, new teacher mentoring and induction, additional job-embedded professional development, performance incentives, and reform of the salary schedule. So these become optional within the recommendations of a new aligned statute between the two existing statutes. That's the summation of the report that you have in front of you, and I think now we would be available and open for questions.
And Madam Chair and members of the committee, I think you should have a graphic like this in your packet. I think this kind of lays it out, you know, in one page and should be helpful. And one thing I would like to note about the probationary teacher statement that was made earlier, one of the things we found as we were looking at the implementation of especially teacher eval was what was written in statute was kind of not workable, because if you go back to the probationary teachers, it says you have to have three evaluations within the first year, and you have to have one within 90 days, and it has to comply with subdivision 8, which is all the requirements. Well, one of the requirements is to have data on student growth, having student engagement information. So to do that with a probationary teacher within their first 90 days probably isn't very workable anywhere, because you just don't have that information. We think that at the time we were talking maybe about having observations of teacher practice or something else. That recommendation is just added to say maybe we need to clean up the statute a little bit as it relates to the probationary teacher to make it more workable so that the districts, I'm not going to have to tell them that they have to do all these things within the first 90 days because they probably don't have the data on student achievement in order to make that happen. So it's more of a cleanup recommendation.
Thank you. All right. Before we get to your question, Representative Erickson and the others, I do have to do a little housekeeping. So Representative Detmer, would you move the minutes from the February 3rd meeting?
Madam Chair, so do.
Thank you. Any discussion? Not all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Minutes from February 3rd are approved. Representative Wills, did you have a question?
I may be jumping the gun, but I was just going to have a comment on the next set of minutes.
All right. Very well. So, Representative Wills, you recognize your comments. We are moving to the February 4th minutes. So.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. And on the February 4th minutes, just a couple of quick corrections that I noticed at the end. The third line from the end, delete the period at the end of that line. Actually, I apologize. That would be the fourth line. And then the third line, delete the period at the end. And then the second from the bottom, after the word education, so the joint education, after the word education, insert finance committee.
Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, I want to advise the committee to follow Representative Will's wise counsel. Quite seriously, she actually bailed us up a few times last year by capturing some of the mistakes that we had. So it's good to see that you're still in good form, Representative Wills.
Thank you. Well, Representative Wills, I would entertain a motion for alterations or corrections to the minutes. As you have so outlined.
Do we have to move to amend? Or
I believe we have to move to amend the minutes. So if you would move to amend the minutes.
I would
minutes.
Move to amend the minutes with those three corrections.
All right. I'm sorry, you're right. I didn't bring up. So we are now motion on the minutes from the February 4th meeting. And Representative Wills moves amendment of those minutes. Anybody need that restated, Representative Erickson?
No, I don't need it restated, Madam Chair, but these are technical changes, and so really there's no motion needed. You're just always supposed to make technical changes. And aside from the insertion of the word finance, the deletion of punctuation would be a technical change, and I think, yeah, finance too, so not to embarrass the person who prepared them. You just have to proof them. I go through it all the time. Luckily, Representative Mariani was not present this morning when my minutes were approved, but I said to my CLA, we are going through these with a fine-tooth comb because we're not going to mess this up. And it was very nice that Representative Seltzer just really purged them, so thank you. So, Madam Chair, I don't think we really need a motion.
Perhaps not, but we've got one okay. On the table, and we'll go ahead and... with the technical corrections, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. So, corrections accepted and minutes approved. Thank you. All right. So, housekeeping done. We will now move on to our questions. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I don't know if you want to have our fiscal staff come up and explain the runs because that basically outlines what the recommendations on finance would cost. I think it's there. I think Mr. Strom pointed out that. If this was implemented to the max for all districts, I think that's the run you have. It also indicates which districts are currently getting QCOM money, which are not. And so we could have greater explanation if you wish. However, if those questions come up, I am going to be asking him to come up and explain that run if you have questions about
it. All right. Let's see. I think let's run through questions first, and then I think we'll get to more detailed information on the finance part. Representative Erickson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the great work that you've done. I know I should have been more a part of this, but you have done excellent in preparing this report for us. And I know you have to use should as your verb because these are recommendations. But in your opinion, either Ms. Sato or Ms. Spies, would you consider these, because I've read through this whole thing now a number of times, that this is more of a must, or are you feeling that some of these recommendations do not carry the weight of a mandate, let's say?
Ms. Spies.
Representative, I do believe that they are a must. This is a full package, and to give integrity to a teacher evaluation program that includes the training mm-hmm. and the feedback and the ongoing cycle of continuous improvement, they really all need to be looked at as a complete package.
So, Madam Chair.
Mr. Erickson.
So, Ms. Hermanson, will you be bringing forth from the department then language that supports this, or are you counting on us legislators to take this up?
Ms. Hermanson.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, the legislature asked us to do it. We came forward with the recommendation. At this point, I'm happy to work with you as you guys developed your response to the legislation. I would like to note that Representative Seltzer sat in several of the meetings. I think you sat in one or two. Mm-hmm. Your staff was there for most of the meetings, so I think they have a clear understanding of what we were talking about. I think Representative Slocum was also at many of the meetings. So we had just for your background, we had districts that were in QComp, districts that weren't in QComp. We had teachers in, teachers that weren't in. We had charter schools that weren't in. So we had a pretty robust committee discussion. Administrative talking about what's a management prerogative versus what should be in these packages. I mean, so I think we covered the field very well. And I think they had a very good discussion and laid out the recommendations. I quite frankly was surprised we did kind of reach pretty good consensus on this. One thing that was added that I'm going to highlight on the funding recommendations, currently the incentives, performance incentives, are primarily individual under QComp. The one thing that was added here is they felt that we also might want to look at school-based incentives, especially under our World's Best Workforce and other issues. We're setting goals by schools or grade levels and stuff, so they said that was one thing that was added that they suggested we might consider as well as ways of using the dollars above the line as you look at your chart.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got two or three questions. I'll try to be real quick with them. Thank you for the work, and thank you for the report as well. I want to refer to page 3 in the handout here to begin with. And recommendation 2, it seems to me this is really critically important. And I want to make sure we don't talk around this issue, because my experience has been that there are a variety of approaches to this work, some that are based, quite frankly, are based on ideological perspectives. Others that are based on particular concerns that don't necessarily involve other concerns. And so recommendation 2 says that in accordance that the as is required, the TDE statute, in accordance with best practice and teacher development in eval, the focus of a locally developed program should be on the, and this is key, development and evaluation of teachers as a means towards improving student outcomes. So the focus should be on development and evaluation. So we're Minnesota Nice. I mean, it's like everyone gets that, But quite frankly, there are folks in the broader community who think that the approach really should be about identifying those bad old teachers out there. And actually, I shouldn't be so glib.
No.
Identifying teachers that are not effective, that are hesitant and resistant to being trained to be effective, and some would argue that are doing damage as a result. And so I don't want to dismiss those concerns at all. However, it seems to me that how you approach this is critically important. That if the approach is to ferret out those bad, those ineffective, those recalcitrant, whatever, teachers, then you wind up with a whole different design
as opposed to a design whose approach is the development and evaluation of teachers. So having said that, is it inconsistent to have an approach dominated on the development and evaluation of teachers that would not identify recalcitrant, harmful, if you will, teachers? Are we giving that up in order to be able to do this?
Who wants to take that one, Dr. Sato?
Madam Chair, I'll start and pass it on to my colleagues. I know those ideological arguments, and I served on the original development of the model task group as well. And the process of the group that developed the evaluation model very much centered on the idea that this could not be what became termed as a gotcha model of evaluation for teachers, that this should not be a witch hunt, that this should be a development process that any strong business would use in a personnel development system. You're trying to identify strengths, you're trying to build on strengths at the same time that you are identifying areas of improvement and putting in place the necessary supports. In teaching, what we understand to be very effective supports for developing teachers are elements like peer coaching and evaluation, opportunities to work with other professionals in the school building, and evaluation that is done by someone who has been trained and knows what they're evaluating for. So the example given earlier of a physics teacher not knowing anything about early childhood development would not be a best practice and should not be supported locally as a practice under the model that came forward from the Department of Education and what they have been training for out in the field. And here I'll give great accolades to the department's work in doing a tremendous amount of development of training materials and support materials and going out across the entire state to work with local districts on how to do this work, because this is a new process, really looking at teaching and observing teaching with very specified observation protocols and looking at student engagement in ways that people have never talked about student engagement at the school level before. So there is a learning curve here going on across the state for administrators, for teachers to understand what it means to have someone really look at your practice and give solid formative feedback to help you develop and grow. And if in that executive summary from the Carey group at the university, some of the strongest feedback from the field in this pilot year was that having an evaluator come in and look at your practice and talk to you about it in meaningful ways, and having peers talk to you about your practice, is a new set of experiences for some of the teachers in Minnesota. So I think that we are on the right track in making this both a development process and something that will have a pack a punch, you know, in terms of improving practice. That does not have the damaging effect that the other ideological side of that argument would have.
So, Representative.
So, Madam Chair, and to the testifiers, so what I'm hearing is that there's a high value, based on research and experience, on a peer-centered supportive environment that could be jeopardized if the approach and the design is really a gotcha design. Is that kind of a blunt, short way to say that?
Madam Chair, I think that is a blunt way to say it, and I think that we can't ignore what I didn't hear in your summary was the other side of that has some consequences attached to it if performance is not where it should be. Now, those consequences could be an individual growth and development plan that is lived out over another 3-year cycle or over a period of time that's established between the evaluator and the teacher. It could be, you know, the teacher having to identify areas that they need to grow and develop in. So it is development and evaluation. So we did not take away the evaluation part of it in the model or in the conversation that came forward or in these recommendations.
Chair.
Representative Murray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's really critically important to just be very plain in our conversation around this, because it seems to me that we've set up this false dichotomy in some circles about how to do this work. You know, you want to get those bad teachers and don't do this, you know, you want to do development work, then don't do that. And so what I'm hearing is that with the framework that we have before us is one that's not inconsistent with one that leads to the appropriate, where it's appropriate, dismissal and counseling out of folks who really should be in the classroom. Is that fair to say?
Madam Chair, Mariette, that is fair to say. Okay. I think Dr. Sato expressed it very well, and I commend the work group in TDE and this joint group for really maintaining that sense as they came forward with recommendations.
Okay. Representative Mariani.
Thank you. I do have some other questions, but in all fairness, so do others, so I'll hold off.
Thank you, and we'll come back around.
Thank you.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifiers. I'm looking at the QCOP aid levy and total revenue sheet, the one sheet. And just maybe it's an observation, and maybe you could comment on the observation. The three districts that I represent, two are in QCOP, one is not. But we're looking at the number of districts. 80 are in QCOP, 250 are not. But you have about the 50-50 split of number of students in the state. Does that mean that your large school districts, metropolitan districts, high population districts, they are in QCOP? Is that what we're saying here?
Madam Chair, Thompson. Representative Detmer, I kind of mentioned that early on, okay. But yes, there is
a preponderance
of okay. larger districts that are in QCOP. I think that you, although we do have rural districts or greater Minnesota districts involved, I would think that number is higher that are not in QCOP. We have worked to try to help them become involved, but there's a run also that's in your packet that lists every district, and I think as you go through that, you will see it. However, we do have some large districts who are not in QCOP, but because there are many more smaller districts, the numbers will be skewed towards smaller districts, more smaller districts not being in. Yeah. That's why we look at both the pupils and the district numbers, because we do have a lot of students who are covered by staff who are working through that process.
And Madam Chair, just a quick follow-up here. Have you ever had districts in QCOP and then leave QCOP and then come back to QCOP?
Yeah. I think the answer to that is yes. Mm-hmm.
It is yes.
Great. Because it's a joint agreement, maybe it didn't work. I mean, we're not sure always of what the reasons behind it, but we have that happen.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for Dr. Sato, in the recommendations, you were talking about funding with a combination of local levy and equalization. Did I hear you correctly that you're talking about charter schools as well as the regular public schools? And if so, this may not be within the purview of the committee, but how would you recommend doing that? And I'm thinking, you know, of charter schools that have students who are from outside of what would traditionally be a normal district. How would you be levying them? And also, just to continue on in the same vein, for say a city like Minneapolis that has multiple charter schools, would each charter school have a separate levy? And maybe this is, you know, I'm just throwing that out.
Ms. Hermanson.
Madam Chair, Representative Newton, I think we do it the same way that we do it now for QCOP. Charter schools are in QCOP, but they have no levy. What they get is the state average amount that a local district may be levying, and that is all state aid, correct? So we have other entities that also do not have levy authority. We have teachers, like some special ed co-ops or intermediate. I mean, there are some other nuances to this program that we would have to work the details out, but how it's been handled with charters so far under QCOP is that is state dollars. All of, if I'm also correct, the levy is equalized, correct? No, but the levy for school districts is equalized. The levy for school districts is also equalized. So intermediates, I mean, they have to, there are some nuances here for employment districts or employment groups that we would have to work out the nuances for.
Representative Newman.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a comment, if I may, as someone who served with this group. I just want to compliment you on your leadership and the entire group on the way they did work together. And the composition of the group was very diverse, and we did come to agreement, and I do think we captured the best of both systems. Being fair, because it's not fair that some districts have QComp and have those dollars for teacher development and to implement a teacher evaluation program, and other districts do, so we accounted for that. We still maintain rigorous high standards, including the 35% based on student outcomes as a quantitative measure, but also maintain those research-based practices that show that really does improve student achievement and really results in that you can see in the report that you got on teacher pay reform and productivity on the very back side, where QComp does show in reading a 5-to-1 return on investment. So I hope that as we bring this forward, that the committee members will seriously consider these recommendations and seriously consider taking them as a whole package, and I do believe that it will be good for student outcomes.
Thank you. I'm going to ask just a question, if I may, before we get to there's three others on the list, and then we actually have two more testifiers I want to make sure we get to before we're done here today. But just with regards to the funding recommendations, you know, we do have the 2% mandated portion of school revenue that we allocated for, you know, teacher development, professional development. And I'm wondering how that amount was factored into your recommendations. Did you consider that completely separate or as part of what you were recommending?
Madam Chair, I'll let the co-chairs also. We did talk about that. Districts that are receiving QCOT money also have that 2% set aside. Just one note, staff development dollars are available for more than just teachers in the district, so they do use those dollars for other things as well. How much, when I was looking through some of the UFARS reports and looking at the amount districts spend versus how much they got, I did observe some districts were spending more than we were giving them under QComp, so I'm assuming they were making up the difference using the staff development dollars or other group funds that they had. But we did talk about that, and I think one of the recommendations says that we should align this with the staff development dollar recommendation number two. It should be aligned with staff development, which is 122.860, but realizing that this is there's a lot of work involved in this, and so those dollars are also welcome. But if you take 2%, and I'm doing my math in my head, of our foundation amount, I think it's around $250 a student, $250. So the QComp districts have about twice that amount of money for the work that they're doing teacher evaluation districts do not have that additional dollar. So, but we did talk about it and decided that we needed those resources in addition to what we were doing.
Thank you. And just to be clear that I understand in your recommendations, they seem to be pointed more towards the process of paying for, again, you know, the observations, the mentoring, the professional development, and kind of leaving the issue of the additional compensation as a locally determined if that would be done or not. And I guess I'm just wondering, kind of getting back to maybe the more information on the QComp, because every district in QComp may do this differently. And so if your recommendations point to needing all of that information or that those dollars, if you will, to perform that, because I know in my own district, which is a QComp district, they set aside a great portion of that for bonuses that every teacher gets.
Right. And Madam Chair, and that was why it's difficult to discern how much is actually going for the payment part, because we asked districts to restructure their salary schedules. And so in restructuring, they may have had to add some dollars to one part of their grid that they didn't have to do before. Many districts are using the bonus concept. Other districts are may have had somebody brought out of the classroom and added on to their responsibilities. That becomes a career ladder opportunity. And so how to factor out how much is going for that part of that program was very difficult to discern. One observation I would make in looking at the UFAR's reports of the QCOM districts I did at, I was expecting to see a great deal more money being spent on substitute teachers. I found little, which led me to believe that districts were finding ways to accomplish what they needed to do either by within their own staffing patterns or brought on additional staff to get the work done. So there are some things you can discern, but the incentives and the amount of money spent on salaries was the one very difficult to pull out. In total, we could, but how it was being done was more difficult.
Thank you. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My questions follow exactly what we were just talking about here. I think there's a conundrum, and I understand the task force was in a tough position because you're trying to match funds with the QCOM because it's politically you can't take money away from someone who already has it. And I know the 100, let's just focus on the property tax, the aid from the, I should say the aid from the state, and that's at $169. And in the proposal here, it's $169 per kid for those now non-QCOM. And I guess I understand how the $169 came out for this proposal, but does anyone know how the $169 came about for QComp? I mean, how was that number determined, or was it because we had X amount of money and then it was divided by the number of kids that were in the program?
Ms. Ermans.
Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, that's a very good question. I do know that the original program was all state aid and $150 per pupil. I think also that as the QComp program, having been around here a little bit of this time, as the QComp program went forward and they looked at some of the responsibilities and things they had to do, it grew. Part is an incentive to get people to do it, but also part of what was being required for them to do. And that's why we did go back and look in the UFAR stuff, say what is this stuff really being spent on. I don't think anyone can really answer the bottom line of your question, but I do think that there is probably enough evidence to say that it's probably this costly to do a good teacher evaluation system, especially when you get into the professional development part of this and putting in place the support systems.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Hermanson, your comment about where you're a little bit surprised by the lack of substitute teachers. And we've gone through the process of the new teacher evaluation and development program at DGF. And in fact, this year I got the summative and I come up with my individual growth plan and went through the process actually this year. And I will first of all say I think it is an excellent program that is really going to improve teacher quality and student performance. I have no doubt by a couple years we've gone through it, but this year for the first year. We had to come up as a teacher. I've taught 31 years, and I don't think my relationship with the students are going to, or my enthusiasm has changed, but looking at more student data, aligning things, and now we're going to have a pre-test and exit test, so forth, aligned to the standards. I mean, in that respect, I'm going to be a better teacher. But, you know, I calculated for my district, and I hope my superintendent isn't listening. Because, no, he does a wonderful job, but at 1,600 students at $169, that's $270,000 that would come into Dilworth, Glenn, and Felton. I know that's not costing that much. Because I calculated even if we hired a new principal just to do the evaluation, and every one of our 122 teachers took three complete days off and had to be filled with subs, that would only be half of the $270,000. And so I'm just... Yes, I know this, but I don't think we know what the costs are of this program yet. And I understand why you need the 169 too, and maybe there's some discussion. And then my last and final question is what happens if there is no funding for this? Because that currently, just to cover the state aid portion, it looks, when I calculate the students, it's roughly $73, $74 million would be needed. What happens? Does it compromise our teacher evaluation system if there is no funding for this? And that would be it. I could go on, but that's
thank you.
Fine. Thanks.
Dr. Sandler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I love the back-of-the-envelope calculations that you're doing because it really does help get into some specifics, but there are lots of things that go into this development of a new system that I would just offer to the committee who haven't done the same calculations you have. You know, this is new data collection, and so there are some districts that don't have formalized protocols for observing teachers or for looking at student engagement. So districts have spent money on adopting surveys or developing surveys, and those have to be developed over time. So there's an expectation of reliability and validity of these instruments because high-stakes decisions could be made, like employment. And so the quality of the instruments for collecting engagement of students over time needs to be maintained. You know, at the university, we spend a lot more than $270,000 when we develop high-quality instruments for collecting data that we think is going to have some valuable information for us, and we want people to trust it and rely on it, especially if high-stakes decisions will be made. Data collection systems, sometimes this is a technology infrastructure that needs to be built. Some districts don't have technology infrastructures or people who can run data from surveys or aggregate data from observations over time or even house a 3-year cycle of teacher observations over time. Paper files will not allow a system to do this in an efficient way that will allow for decision making and ongoing development to be really robust. Observing, like training people to do the observations, in the example given before, that was not a trained observer example. So putting training in place is more professional development time and resources, and sometimes you need outside expertise to help develop those training materials. MDE has done a lot of development of materials, but locally developed training will still need to be in place. And as you move through time, ongoing training of those observers will need to be kept up over time. So those are just some examples. If you do peer coaching, there is release time, or there are, if you look at the QComp, most of the QComp models do have pull-out mentoring programs where you need to replace the teacher in the classroom to cycle them out to be a mentor for 2 or 3 years, you know, across a district. So replacing personnel for the mentors who are doing, you know, ongoing peer coaching is another cost. So one teacher's salary, that amount that you quoted, if you pulled out 3 teachers, that's 3 teacher salaries, and that's already putting you up, you know, well over $100,000, $150,000 for having pull-out mentoring time for teachers. So there are many different elements of what's required in statute between the observation of teachers, the collection of engagement data, and I didn't even talk about developing student growth measures because we can't rely on all of the MCA data for that. And so districts are now developing local growth measures at grade levels, at course levels, and that is development time. That's either teachers' time in the summer or hiring experts to come in and help you develop. And curriculum doesn't stay static. You have to keep up those growth measures. So once developed in a year, you might use those for 3 or 4 years, but those need to be redeveloped over time as well if you want to keep the reliability of those student growth measures high. So these are new technologies that we have not had, you know, institutionally across the state. 1 or 2 districts might have it, but not system-wide. And the dollars do add up very quickly.
And Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, yes, one thing I'd add, one of the things that we found in our first review of the data coming back from the pilots is around helping teachers where we don't have readily available assessments develop their student learning goals and how to measure them. Because you have a FIED teacher you have to evaluate. You have special ed teachers you need to evaluate. You have CTE, or career technical ed educators. And so that system within each district has to be developed specific to that teacher. And so the one thing that the report showed us they really liked was the work that the department was doing in helping them come up with a way of determining that 35% growth are tied to some, well, they don't all have the test scores, but some type of student learning goals and ways of measuring it. So all of these things they're in the development stage, and I think it's going to take some time. One other comment I would make is I've had some districts, primarily rural, where they don't have the specialists and people to help them with this. They are struggling a little more because they fundamentally, if they have 20, 25 teachers, getting all this work done, they have to do the same number of things across the same number of content areas, but they don't have as many people. And so there are some uniquenesses for the smaller districts and why they are probably lagging a little bit in the development of their teacher evaluation plan.
Thank you. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does any of the QCOMP schools have four-day weeks or alternative schedules?
Madam Chair, I'm going to let Christy Anderson answer that.
Thank you.
Hi, if you'd please state your name for the record.
Sure. Christy Anderson with the Minnesota Department of Education. Madam Chair, Representative, there are a couple of our districts that do, one specifically in far northern Minnesota and one just outside of the metro that use four-day weeks. They use that time often for the professional development for their teachers to get together and do some of those things in their learning communities.
Representative Murphy.
And Madam Chair, Ms. Anderson, are they on the same timeline for the evaluation assessments?
It varies, their calendars, how they've laid that out, but it generally follows a similar pattern, yes.
Representative Murphy.
I don't know.
Sorry, I can't see you.
I don't know what else to add but or to ask, but I'm interested in the answer.
We can certainly get some more information for you on that if you'd like.
I would very much appreciate that.
All right. Thank you. All right. I think at this point we've got two other testifiers we want to get up, so then we'll come back to member questions as time allows. And so I would ask, and if the rest of the presenters, if you would not go too far, just in case we come back to you. Thank you. We have a representative from Education Minnesota and also from Educators for Excellence. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, Madam Chair members. Yeah. I'm Katie Perry. I'm here on behalf of Education Minnesota, and I served as our representative on the Teacher Development and Evaluation Alternative Teacher Professional Pay System Alignment Work Group. I think it's the longest titled group I ever served on. And I thank you for the time today to speak in favor of, in support of the group's recommendations. I'd just like to note that before joining the Education Minnesota staff, I taught high school English and Spanish for many years, and I was lucky enough to work in a district that adopted an ATPPS plan. And I'd like you to know that the innovations and the funding provided by that plan were transformative for me and for my colleagues. For the first time, we had a framework, time, and funding to collaborate. We were able to design common assessments and examine student work together. We were able to work with special educators and other specialists to look at our practice and see how to improve our instruction, especially to help our struggling students. We as teachers were able to review and revise the plan each year in collaboration with administrators. It provided a unique, and for the first time in my decades of experience, a venue for teacher voice in matters of instruction and those matters that mean the most to teachers. We learned as a staff, as you've heard other people say this afternoon, to examine data and assess our work to improve our instruction. Outstanding teachers had a process, time, and a little compensation in order to observe and coach their colleagues. The collaboration tapped into the expertise of all so that we all became smarter and more effective in our instruction. The confidentiality of that process, as you've heard earlier, allowed for frank and meaningful professional conversations. We at Education Minnesota support the workgroup recommendations. We'd just like to highlight a couple of key points. Adequate funding of the recommendations is critical to the success of teacher development and evaluation. Teacher development and evaluation, two different things. In our experience, it was the money or the time needed to do the work that allowed our program to succeed. It is absolutely essential, as Ms. Spies and Dr. Sato have emphasized, that the recommendations of the work group be taken as a whole, and that adequate and equitable funding be provided. Continued flexibility and local control is also essential. because we could design our plan to suit the needs of our students and to alter it as needed, it succeeds. One of the hallmarks of the ATPPS plans is that they can be designed to work in large urban districts like mine, or in tiny districts like Rentschel. In my work at Education Minnesota, I've helped districts who want to have ATPPS plans develop them, and I had a great time in Rentschel with their very tiny staff figuring out how to make this program work for them, and they have. Districts all over the state have now worked together very hard to come up with their TDE plans, and they beg us as we go out to help support them in those plans to keep those plans in place, to not alter them so that they can make them work, have the time to be sure that everything that they work so hard to put in place has a chance to work for their students and their teachers. I just want to thank you, Madam Chair, and all representatives for the chance to speak today. And thanks to all of you, staff and members, for all the work you do every day to support Minnesota students and their families. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and provide your testimony.
Yep. Shannon Mitchell with Educators for Excellence, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Thank you for allowing us the opportunity to testify here today. Educators for Excellence is a 501c3 with a little over 1,000 teacher members. One of our teacher members, Taylor Reeb, addressed your committee about 2 weeks ago in January to share with you some of our legislative priorities. One of our legislative priorities is QCOMP. Our members selected that as a topic that they were really interested in weighing in on, and 15 of our classroom teachers then spent time studying QCOMP, interviewing coordinators and other teachers across the state to look at how programs were working, and they also spent time looking at models from other states and really combining that with their classroom experience to come up with a set of recommendations. You'll find those recommendations in the report being passed around. They had a lot of great ideas, and you can read more about that in detail. There is a summary page of all of the recommendations on page 5 and also in the handout that's in there. The two main recommendations that we think are most applicable today when we look at the work that the task force came up with are adequate funding for teacher evaluation across districts, and then keeping QCOMP, the components intact, and the funding available for QCOMP programming. So first I'll touch on our first priority of the adequate funding. Our teachers really felt that as they were writing these recommendations, that teacher evaluation was the most critical part of QCOMP, and also growth and development for teachers not in QCOMP districts. And to build a high-quality QCOMP system, that you had to start on the foundation of teacher evaluations. So they felt it was critical, and to implement a multi-measured and valid system, our teachers really felt that took funding. So they support the working group's recommendation that there needs to be some funding for this. One thing the recommendations do highlight, though, is that QCOMP and its five components really work together, and the program is getting results. Our teachers were inspired by the stories they heard from their colleagues within their schools and across the state. They were also persuaded by the research out there. The most recent study that came out from the U of M and St. Thomas labor economists, Christine West and Aaron Sojourner, highlights that QCOMP is getting results. It up to a whole month's worth of reading achievement. They were convinced that this was something important, and they were also persuaded by the fact that the researchers tried to tease out which of the five QCOMP components were getting these results, and they couldn't do it, which suggested to our teachers that it worked really well together as a program. For those reasons, we think that QCOMP should be funded at a much higher level than teacher evaluation, because it is a lot more than just teacher evaluation. And then the other item that our teachers recommended in their paper that I'd like to highlight that I think is applicable for today is this idea that the performance pay component of QCOMP, there should be a little more flexibility within that component. There are currently three ways that you can give those bonuses out, and they're for school-wide goals, which inspires collaboration, and our teachers like that part. Individual student growth goals, and then teacher evaluations. They think there should be a fourth prong that allows districts more flexibility to reward teachers for moving to hard staff schools and staying in them, so that we can get teachers in front of great teachers in front of the kids that need them most. And we think districts should have that flexibility to use the dollars within this programming to do that. Those are the things that they wanted to highlight for you all, and I'm happy to answer questions if there are any. Thanks again, Madam Chair, for the opportunity.
Thank you. And I think Representative Quam, I think I had you on the list, and I'm sorry I missed you in the first round. Do you have a question for these testifiers or the previous panel? Pardon?
One for this one.
No, for this one, okay. Any other questions for the panel that just testified? Or I'll have all the panelists come down. Any additional questions? And you start, you may lead off, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And there was some correlated to this in the fact that the fourth sort of gets into what I believe Florida and a few states have. If your class has a high portion of lower history performing students, you get a bonus factor for how much you raise that lowest quartile in growth, and that might be something they could look at. But the comment about compensation, frankly, I'd like to have more data, even if it's not fully massaged and packaged. Recommendation 6, is that doled out by just seniority, and then also is it just limited to tenured?
Let's see, who went, Ms. Hermanson or Ms. Bees, whoever wants to take that one.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, in our look at these roles, this is your career ladder roles. This is not, in at least in most of the districts I have, this is not done by seniority. It's done by the skill set of the individual, and Ms. Spies can answer. She's the QCOMP coordinator in Bloomington, where they do have those roles. Many times I have observed that they turn them over because usually they're your better teachers, and you don't necessarily want them out of the classroom all the time. You want them working with kids. In some districts, they have a combination of roles, which is a peer reviewer or a coach, and teaching kids. And so even at the inception of the original teacher alternative pay system, there was a specific reference in statute that they wanted to develop career paths for teachers that allowed them to continue to interact and work with children as a classroom instructor. And I'll let Ms. Spies add anything to this.
Ms. Spies. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. That is correct. Just to add to what Rose said, we have term limits. It's part of QCOMP, and we also allow several different types of leadership positions. They can be smaller roles that they maintain their classroom responsibilities, or they can be roles that would take them out of the classroom for a short period of time, those teachers to share the skills that they have in working with students with other teachers.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then on the recommendations for funding, again, the whole thing, I like everything. I would envision, first of all, that the new teacher mentoring and support and the professional development that's listed on the 3 should actually be part of 2 and above the, a switch of the voluntary inquired lines, I think would be better distribution. But frankly, funding-wise, a lot of this we should have been doing with 2% staff development, improving the professional development of the teachers, and I'd frankly like to see those dollars used towards this besides just adding new dollars.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, we talked about where it belonged on the line. We have districts that don't have any new teachers, because they haven't hired in a while. So we had to think about the reality out in the field. I think teacher induction and mentoring was a very strong component of what the group supported. But again, it's what's really going on out there in the schools, and if I don't want to force a district that hasn't hired any new teachers to have to put in place an induction program is one part of that. But I will say that that induction part is critical. That's why we went in a little bit to the probationary teacher language and said, let's make this more real and more meaningful. I know some districts actually have a process where you earn your tenure status, and they're very rigorous. So I think our goals here are the same, but we're trying to be practical about maybe implementation.
Thank you. All right. Well, we run a little bit over, but we start a little late. So I appreciate all of you taking the time to be here. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We appreciate the opportunity to present the recommendations.
Thank you. All right. Committee is adjourned.